Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. It's my pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Colonel Peter Mansour, Chair of Military History at Ohio State University. Until his academic appointment earlier this year, Colonel Mansour spent more than 25 distinguished years in the U.S. military, most recently as executive officer to General David Petraeus, commander of multinational forces in Iraq. In this position, Colonel Mansour assisted General Petraeus with strategic planning in Iraq and prepared General Petraeus for meetings with President Bush, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, and the National Security Council. Colonel Mansour was one of the major authors of the report on the situation in Iraq, which was delivered by General Petraeus to Congress last year. Previously, Colonel Mansour served on the Council of Colonels that enabled the Joint Chiefs of Staff to reassess the strategy for the Iraq War. Based in part on this group's work, the United States began the surge strategy in Iraq. In 2003 and 2004, Colonel Mansour served as commander of the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Armored Division, which was responsible for security and stability in two Baghdad districts that incorporate 2.1 million people. After the April 2004 uprising of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, Mansour's brigade combat team restored the city of Karbala to coalition control within 3 weeks, which earned the organization a presidential citation. Colonel Mansour has written about his experiences as an Iraq commander in the new book, Baghdad at Sunrise. The book's title refers to Iraq's rebirth, to the fact that this country of ancient civilizations is hopefully entering a new phase with the help of the American military. Please welcome Colonel Peter Mansour.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting me this afternoon to discuss my latest book, Baghdad at Sunrise, A Brigade Commander's War in Iraq. It's always a pleasure to get back to Northern California, having grown up in Sacramento and lived there for 12 years. I'm a ardent San Francisco 49er fan, and it's great to get back to the city. Okay, forget Iraq. Can we talk about the Niners? Back to the glory years, I say. Interestingly enough, the last time I was in San Francisco on official business was in 1978, when I had been appointed to go to the United States Military Academy at West Point, and they held a dinner for the incoming class at the Presidio. And I went there for a nice event. And I think that this event here today puts a great bookend on that experience 30 years later. So thanks for having me. Why did I write Baghdad at Sunrise? I actually started with a journal. I decided that being in combat for the first time, this was going to be a formative event in my life, maybe the culminating event in my life. And so I kept a daily journal, really to pass down to my kids. And every day, no matter how late it was, usually very late at night, I'd pen a few entries into the journal on what was happening that day, what my thoughts were. And then I decided when I got back from Iraq that after looking at what I had written, that maybe I could clean this up a bit for my kids and grandkids and actually produce a personal manuscript. So I started writing. And then the more I wrote, the more I decided, well, you know, this could really fill a broader need to explain what went right and wrong in that very first and decisive year of the conflict in Iraq, and maybe pen some lessons learned for the United States Army, the military as a whole, and our nation as we go forward in this long struggle against al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, and face the reshaping of the Middle East in an age of globalization. So that's where the book came from. But I really think after having written it and having looked at the other literature that's come out on the war so far, that it fills a really critical gap in the historiography of the conflict. What we have so far are several memoirs by relatively junior officers and soldiers, some of which are quite good, but they lack context because they're at a fairly low level, and the soldiers patrolling the streets and clearing rooms, house to house, and so forth. But so you have that on one hand, and then on the other hand, you have very high-level memoirs by Ambassador Bremer, General Sanchez, Douglas Feith, and so forth, which tend to do this. It was his fault. And nothing in between until Baghdad at sunrise. It fills that critical gap in command in counterinsurgency operations at the brigade level. And why was Iraq a brigade commander's war? Because after all, that's the subtitle of the book. The brigade was the first level that had all the assets necessary to fight a counterinsurgency conflict. Civil affairs, psychological operations units, engineers, military police, counterintelligence units, and so forth. The second thing is brigade commanders own the ground. Just about every part of Iraq was carved up, and there was a unit responsible for most areas of the country. And it was the brigade commanders that were responsible for, and the troops underneath them, for bringing stability and security to those areas. So unless you understand what's going on in each of the brigade's areas, you don't really understand the conflict as a whole. And finally, they provided a really necessary link between the civil authorities in the Coalition Provisional Authority and the military command, which held the responsibility for providing security to the country. The other thing is we had the authority to spend money, and money in a counterinsurgency conflict is a weapon, every bit as important as bullets. And we had a program called the Commander's Emergency Response Fund, and it was brigade commanders that were given the authority to spend this money and allocate it. So for all these reasons, you have to look, I think, at brigade levels to get a really good feeling for what's happening in Iraq. And like I said, I think that first year of the conflict, from the summer of 2003 to the summer of 2004, is an absolutely critical period in the war. It was a period in which we might have been able to forestall the insurgency altogether with the right decisions, or end it relatively quickly after it began, again, with the right decisions, and we can get into that. I wrote also, as I went along with the manuscript, I decided that I would write Baghdad at Sunrise. Unlike my first book, The GI Offensive in Europe, which is an academic monograph based on my dissertation, I wrote Baghdad at Sunrise for the general reader. Hopefully it's not just a book not just a story worth telling, but a story well told. My ruler and gauge in that regard is my daughter, who's a sophomore at the University of Kansas. And she read the book, and she goes, "Dad, you have to get on The Daily Show." And I said, well, okay, if she thought it was good enough for me to get on The Daily Show, then it must be a good book for the general reader. There were many early mistakes made in that first year of the conflict, which really, I think, paved the way to the horrific sectarian violence that we saw in Iraq in 2006 and 2007. The expectation going in was that Iraq would be like Kosovo on steroids, a large peacekeeping operation, but that once we destroyed the Saddam Hussein's government and the Ba'athist apparatus of government that kept it in power for 30 years or more, that the Iraqis would pretty much welcome us as liberators, and that it would be a matter of civic action and humanitarian action to care for the population, but that there wouldn't be a huge security component to what went on. I don't believe that the Bush administration, or the military for that matter, understood the forces at work in Iraq before we entered the country. This was an operation for the future of the Iraqi people. They were at a new sunrise in their existence. The title is a metaphor. But it would take time, blood, and treasure to bring the situation under control. A new day had dawned, But whether that day would be sunny or stormy remained to be seen. And in fact, in many regards, we spawned a hurricane. The fundamental error this administration made was not understanding the nature of the war that they had embarked upon. There's a prominent military philosopher, Karl von Clausewitz, who wrote a book called On War in the early 19th century, which has stood the test of time over the years as a piece of war philosophy. And he writes in it that the first, the supreme, the most far-reaching judgment, act of judgment that the statesman and commander have to make is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking, neither mistaking it for nor trying to turn it into something that is alien to its nature. Now, this administration justified the invasion of Iraq based on national security, the proverbial mushroom clouds over American cities and the need to destroy the non-existent weapons of mass destruction. But in fact, they thought it would be a war of liberation, that the Iraqis would welcome us and that there would not be a lot of pushback once the regime had been toppled. These assumptions should have been re-examined by the summer of 2003 at the latest. And when they were not, when the Secretary of Defense instead said, well, we're just up against a bunch of dead enders, it made it very, very difficult for commanders on the ground to justify what they were seeing on the streets with what was being said in Washington. The evidence for the emergence of the insurgency was clear and should have led to a comprehensive reevaluation of the war effort, from political policy to strategy, and from the operational concept to tactics, techniques, and procedures. Regrettably, it did not. The administration had gone to war with a preconceived notion of the kind of war it wanted to fight, and when presented evidence to the contrary, it simply stuck its head in the sand. As for Combined Joint Task Force 7, which was the military organization under the command of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, it lacked more than just enough troops to accomplish the mission. It lacked imagination and insight into Iraqi history and culture and their impact on the mission, along with a realistic understanding of what was happening on the ground. These strategic errors were compounded by the lack of planning for post-hostilities, the so-called Phase 4 planning, which was skimpy at best. I think by way of comparison, we can look at our effort in World War II, where George C. Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, established a group to look at the needs of a post-conflict Germany and the military occupation of a defeated Germany in January 1942, 1 month after Pearl Harbor was bombed, and 3 years plus before the war was over. With this administration, which began an analysis of post-conflict Iraq about 2 months before the invasion began and Baghdad fell. Ambassador Bremer contributed to the strategic errors in the planning effort by sowing the seeds of the insurgency with two critical decisions, now well known. The first one being the de-bathification of Iraqi society, which was okay to a certain level, but he brought it down to such a level that common professors, most of the civil servants, engineers, and so forth, were booted out of their jobs with a stroke of the pen. And the second was the disbanding of the Iraqi army, which was about the only truly national institution that was left in Iraq once we toppled the government. These two decisions created a disenfranchised and disenchanted group of ex-military officers, ex-bureaucrats, who formed the basis for the leadership of the insurgency. I think had these decisions been otherwise, we might have been able to forestall the insurgency altogether with the right approach to the post-conflict in Iraq. The inexorable calculus of war then led to a growing insurgency, and the hoped-for campaign for liberation turned into an arduous occupation. And we then had to fight to stabilize Iraq, build legitimate governmental institutions where none now existed, and bring some sort of order back to the streets. The summer of 2003 was very chaotic. We were fighting more than just a growing insurgency. There was a large number of criminal groups. Over 100,000 prisoners had been released by Saddam Hussein 9 months earlier. And they were on the streets kidnapping, robbing, and creating mayhem. Widespread looting in the wake of the invasion had all but destroyed the infrastructure of Iraq, to include most of the government offices, water treatment plants, electrical substations, schools, hospitals, and whatnot. Iraqis, by the way, I think take looting to a new art form. I went into some buildings that literally have nothing but walls and a floor. Even the electrical switches, the wall outlets, the light fixtures, the plumbing, the wiring, everything was taken out. We didn't do anything to stop the looting. Now, this has happened before my brigade got on the ground. But if you look back at the history, and you don't have to look that far back in the history, all you have to do is go back 10 years, and you have the invasion of Panama, the LA riots in 1992, Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo, all of which suggests that in the absence of solid police or military authority and security on the streets, that you're going to have looting. And yet we did nothing to prepare for it, and we get that very famous quote from Rumsfeld, "Freedom is messy, stuff happens." In the summer of 2003, we lacked forces to provide security, especially, as I said, after Bremer disbanded the Iraqi army. Now, the Army Chief of Staff, Eric Shinseki, warned Congress, and by way of Congress, the administration, that the occupation of Iraq would take several hundred thousand troops. Now, he did this in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee in February of 2003, only to be neutered by the Secretary of Defense and his undersecretary, who called his assumption that it would take several hundred thousand troops to restore security in Iraq wildly off the mark. And they proceeded, they followed that up with naming his replacement a full year before it was time for him to leave office, which made him a lame duck. It was a warning to other officers that they shouldn't speak up and challenge the assumptions on which the war was based. Again, a problem that carried on through that first year when what we were seeing on the ground did not match the rhetoric from Washington. In terms of number of troops, I can give you some quick numbers. I had a brigade combat team of 3,500 soldiers, and we were in an area of central and northeast Baghdad that had about 2.1 million Iraqis. That's about a ratio of security forces to population of about one security person for every 600 citizens. By way of comparison, the New York City Police Force has 39,000 officers for a city of 8.1 million, which is about one police officer for every 200 citizens in a much more benign environment. And in fact, the counterinsurgency manual, which I helped to edit, says that historically, in an insurgency, to counter it, you need about one security person for every 50 people. So we had far fewer than the number of troops we needed, and as a result, we had to improvise on the ground, and the troops and commanders had to make do with what they had. The resulting chaos over that summer led to significant disillusionment with the United States among the Iraqi people, many of whom had cheered the fall of Saddam Hussein. They certainly had no love for a brutal dictator who had killed hundreds of thousands of their countrymen. But when we couldn't make Baghdad look like Los Angeles within a matter of weeks, they thought, here's the most powerful nation on earth, can't even get the electricity to run, where are we headed from here? And this was compounded by the insurgents who started to attack both our forces and the infrastructure as well. Even with that, the inability to forestall the insurgency in the first place, we had opportunities to end it in that first year. Slowly over time, we got control of the area. We hired Iraqis to guard fixed facilities. That freed up our forces to do more intensive security operations. Uday and Qusay Hussein were killed in July of 2003, and Saddam himself was captured in December, which took the wind out of the sails of the Ba'athist resistance. Quick vignette about the death of Uday and Qusay Hussein. I was taking a shower on top of the Martyrs Monument where my headquarters was based. It was just a marble slab with some onion dome structures in place. But we had this solar-heated, gravity-fed shower up there, and I was taking a shower. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, I look up, and it looks like the 4th of July, all this tracer fire going up in the air, and I go, wow, that looks like the 4th of July. It's really beautiful. And then I realized those were bullets going up in the air, and gravity was going to take hold at some point. And this was a lot of fire going up in the air. And so I quickly put on a pair of shorts, ran down into my tactical operations center, and put out the word over the radio for all the soldiers to get indoors, to put on body armor and Kevlar helmets to be safe from the rain of lead that was going to come down. And sure enough, in celebrating the death of Uday and Qusay Hussein, over 50 Iraqis were killed that night by falling bullets. Iraqis tend to sleep on the roofs of their houses to get out of the heat inside, and it was just it's just another tragedy. But it was. And it occurred again once Saddam was captured in December. Same thing, although we were ready for it that time. So we were able to take out the top leadership. The insurgents launched a major offensive during Ramadan of that year, which was October, November 2003, and we defeated it decisively. And these events all grouped together really took the wind out of the sails of the insurgency for a brief period. January, February, of March of 2004 had a level of violence not unlike what the level is in Iraq today. And in fact, commentators today talk about how much safer Iraq is, how much the violence has dropped, and so forth. It's about the same level as it was those first 3 months of 2004. And I believe that the insurgency could have been ended then had we made the correct political overtures to the Sunnis to bring them back into the process. Instead, Ambassador Bremer continued his business as usual and continued to rely on a weak and very sectarian Iraqi governing council, which empowered very sectarian political parties and tried to impose democracy or a representative form of government from the top down versus building stakeholders in the new Iraq from the bottom up. The result was a radicalization of the insurgency as Islamic militants gained the upper hand in the wake of the defeat of the Baathist-led insurgency. In April 2004, that brief window to end the insurgency collapsed with twin uprisings in Fallujah and across South Central Iraq when the militia of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, the Jaish al-Mahdi, rose up. It was a very tense moment for coalition forces in Iraq. And in fact, the main supply route from Kuwait up to Baghdad had been cut with the destruction of 5 bridges along the route. And for a period of time, no supplies got through to Baghdad. My division, the 1st Armored Division, was on its way home after nearly a year in combat. And we were turned around at the port to come back up and restore control to the cities of South Central Iraq that had been taken over by the Jaish al-Mahdi. In some very, very tough fighting, we were able to restore coalition control to Sadr City, Karbala, Najaf, Kut, Diwaniya, and other places in South Central Iraq. And again, in conjunction with the Marine offensive into Fallujah, we made it possible, if not to achieve a political victory in Iraq, at least to achieve a military victory. Instead, Ambassador Bremer, having ordered the assault on Fallujah, ordered it stopped before it reached its ultimate conclusion. And with the Jaish al-Mahdi, he offered Muqtada al-Sadr a ceasefire rather than demanding that he either go into exile or go into coalition or Iraqi custody for his misdeeds. We had missed a major opportunity to end the insurgency by bringing the Sunnis back into the political process and instead created the conditions for the division of Iraq along sectarian lines, which we saw occur the next 2 years. Even then, the sacrifices of the Ready First Combat Team and other units in defeating the Shia uprising across south-central Iraq in the spring of 2004, along with the Marine offensive in Fallujah, could have led to a resounding military success against the insurgency. Instead, these potential successes were wiped out by weak political leadership that halted the offensive in Fallujah just when it showed promise, and likewise allowed Muqtada al-Sadr to escape the consequences of his reckless and irresponsible actions. Let me sum up. In the book, there is a series of lessons learned for the United States as we move forward into the 21st century and fight more of these conflicts, because we will have to fight more of these conflicts. Enemies will not challenge the United States with conventional military force. We are the most powerful nation on earth. Our conventional forces are much stronger and more capable than those of any nation state on the planet today. But if we want to be challenged, if nations want to challenge us, or other groups, non-state actors want to challenge us, they will do so in asymmetric ways or with irregular warfare. So I contend that we haven't seen the last of counterinsurgency in Iraq or even in Afghanistan. We have to fight the wars we must fight, and not necessarily just the wars we want to fight. And this is going to require more than just these rapid, decisive operations fought with high technology at extended distances with a very light footprint. It's going to take boots on the ground. And I think, as we saw in Iraq, that shock and awe is really shock and awful. We need balanced warfighting capabilities, and we need to go to war as a people. This is a lesson for our political leadership. They cannot allow America to fight wars with a small sliver of the population and have a divided country behind them. The United States, if it is to succeed as a world power in the 21st century, needs to come to some sort of bipartisan consensus on the ends of foreign policy, and then come together as a people to support those ends. I think I'm going to end there, and we can turn it over to Q&A and continue the dialogue. Thank you.
Our thanks to Peter Mansour for your comments today. We do have a large number of questions. Several revolve around the idea of leaving or staying in Iraq. Now, in your speech and also in your book, you talk about the fact that you imply, really, that the war may have been a mistake. And I believe, you know, now, as you intimated today, you believe that the war was a mistake. And nevertheless, we have the consequences of what happened. What should the U.S. military do? In a way, though, the bigger question is, what should the United States do in terms of staying in Iraq, leaving, a time frame? These are questions that are all, of course, being debated by our presidential candidates. What do you have to say about the exit or stay strategy?
Right. Well, actually, I do believe it was a significant strategic error to go into Iraq in the first place. We had a strategy of containing Saddam Hussein that was working. And by the way, we were also containing Iraq or Iran at the same time. But having said that, we are where we are, and we have to deal with the situation as it exists in 2008 and not the situation as we wish it were in 2003. The troops we have on the ground right now fulfill a really critical role. They are the honest brokers in Iraq right now. And I believe if they were to be withdrawn in a relatively rapid fashion, that you would see Iraq dissolve once again into sectarian violence as different groups jostle militarily for resources and power. I believe Iraq has the capability to emerge as a stable state in the Middle East, given time. But it must be given time to come to a political consensus on the way ahead, which is slowly emerging, but again, slowly emerging. It's our troops that give us the leverage with the Iraqi government to nudge them in the right direction. And they have shown some progress this year with the Provincial Powers Act, amnesty legislation for former insurgents, now a provincial elections law, and so forth. So these are really critical pieces of legislation, but what really is important going forward is, are the Sunnis brought back into the political process and given a piece of the resources and power that will enable them to say, yes, we want to be part of this representative government and be part of Iraq for all Iraqis? The other side of that is, will the Iraqi government prove that it is more than just a Shia sectarian government and show that it is willing to be a government for all of Iraq? I believe this is going to take a number of years to play out, quite frankly, not decades, as some say that we should be there, you know, for as long as it takes, but certainly not months either. So that leaves us somewhere in the range of 2 to 9 years, but probably towards the latter end of that that spectrum of time. If we really want to see a stable Iraq emerge that's sustainable for the long term, and I think that's in our national interest.
Two to 9 years is a long time, especially in political years. During this presidential season, we've had the two candidates debate about how long the U.S. should be in Iraq. Senator Obama suggests that the troops should be withdrawn within several years, 2 years, which is definitely the far end of your...
The near end, yeah.
Yeah, the near end, yes. Would you have any advice for Senator Obama, probably maybe not McCain, but for Senator Obama, in terms of his belief in that time frame?
Well, I would encourage Senator Obama to look at what gives us leverage in Iraq. If you want to create a stable Iraqi state and not have the situation devolve once again into sectarian violence and chaos, which would be bad on a number of levels, humanitarian, the flow of oil, the containment of Iran, and so forth, then I think you'll find, looking at it, that it's our troops on the ground that actually give us that leverage. It is, for a variety of reasons, a lot of different groups in Iraq look to U.S. forces as their patron and as the honest broker that keeps Iraq glued together, at least in the near term. And then over time, the creation of sufficient and sufficiently trained Iraqi security forces, political progress in among the Iraqi government, and the improvement of the Iraqi economy will allow us to back off slowly and leave behind a stable and sustainable situation.
A question asks whether who do you think would be the best to navigate a foreign policy in the Middle East, McCain or Obama, and why? Do you have an opinion on that now that you're out of the military and a historian at Ohio State where you can talk liberally about such things?
Well, I think, actually, I admire both Senator McCain and Senator Obama. I think they're both highly intelligent, very dedicated public servants. I happen to think that Senator McCain has a better handle on Iraq, which is the area I really know well, because he's been there a lot. He's consulted extensively with General Petraeus. He understands the needs of counterinsurgency operations, and I can see this in his discussion of the way forward, not just in Iraq, but Afghanistan as well. I'm a little concerned about Senator Obama stating up front that, you know, I'm going to have this 16-month timetable to leave Iraq, and because we're going to leave Iraq, that'll force the Iraqis to get their act together and reconcile with one another. I think it would actually do the opposite. It would tear them apart. And so that would be my concern over his foreign policy. But I think that, you know, they're both quite intelligent men, and we'll go on from there.
if it seems that the war was mistaken and you believe that, is there a sense of pointing the finger at President Bush a lot? Or do you think in the final months of his administration that it's a sort of foolish thing to do and we have to sort of move ahead and move on really to you know, the next president and the next step in Iraq?
Yeah, I think there will be plenty of time for historians to parse what went wrong. But I think this administration made serious mistakes, and strategic errors are the hardest ones to overcome. Much easier to overcome bad tactics, bad organizational concepts. But when you make an error in strategy, sometimes you're not able to overcome it at all. Or other times, maybe the best you can do is get out with, you know, some sort of stalemated situation. this is what kind of the situation we're in Iraq today. I think it's healthy to debate the errors of this administration, but I think it's more important to look at what are the policies going forward from here, because again, this is a no-go-back game. You can't return to go collect $200 and start over again. You've got to deal with matters as they exist today.
Well, that segues into this next question from the audience, and the question is this: now that our economy is in need of billions of dollars, do you think it's time to move our dollars, people, and resources out of Iraq and reinvest in America? And this is a question that's been asked of both presidential candidates.
Yeah. I think a strong economy is a central pillar to the strength of America. What makes us strong and a great power in the world is not just our military forces, but our values as a people and our strong economy. And we need to do what's necessary to get our economy back on track. Having said that, I'm not sure that pulling troops out of Iraq is necessarily the fundamental problem with the economy. It is maybe one of those marginal issues. Because, look, quite frankly, we say we're spending X amount of dollars on the war, but you're going to pay those troops, whether they're in Iraq or Afghanistan or back in the United States. The war is costly, but overall, and in the history of warfare, it's actually not a very expensive war in terms of the percentage of our gross domestic product allocated to the war, which is less than 1% of the GDP that's being spent on Iraq. So, yes, fixing the economy is vital to repairing America's position in the world, but pulling out of Iraq is not necessarily the number one priority in that regard, in fixing the economy.
As a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're speaking with Colonel Peter Mansour about what went right and wrong when the U.S. increased its presence in Iraq. I'm Jonathan Curiel. Now, your book is a diary of your time in Iraq, and it's also an analysis of what's happened there. But one reason this book works, I think, is that it's also a memoir, and it's a narrative of your life. A lot of interesting things in your life, by the way. As you mentioned, you grew up in Sacramento. But one of the things that I found interesting, and you mentioned this in the book as well, is your background. Your father, you are half Palestinian, half Arab, you like to say. And for those of us who've spent time in the Middle East, Mansour is a very important name in the Arab world. It means victorious in Arabic. And when you were in Iraq and you were introduced to Iraqis, they immediately embraced you in a way as being one of them. And you say in the book that you grew up eating Arabic food. And so in that sense, I mean, you felt at home in Iraq. You know, here you were thousands of miles away. You felt at home in Iraq, but it was a sort of mixed blessing. Because at one point in Iraq, you gave a talk and you mentioned that you're half Palestinian, and I think the audience basically was disappointed in that, you know, and you sort of try to comprehend why they were, but at one point people also hung your photo in their wall, in their homes. If you could talk about going to Iraq, not only as a military man, but in terms of you being, you know, half Palestinian.
Yeah, well, ana asli min Ramallah. My origins are from Ramallah. My father is Palestinian and came to the United States in 1938, some time ago, but that does make me first or second generation at the most. It was very interesting. I immediately embraced the tribes in my area. I understood the importance of the tribes to Iraqi society. Early on, I found the Central Council of Baghdad clans, which met weekly, and so I would meet with the tribal sheikhs and try to bring them into the process of moving forward with Iraqi society rather than, putting the tribes on the outside, as Ambassador Bremer did. He didn't even meet with the tribes for over a year. He decided that he was going to recreate Iraqi society in some sort of new Western image, and that's a recipe for disaster. But I met with the tribal sheikhs, and there's a great vignette in the book where I'm actually at the podium or at the dais with some of the more senior sheikhs in the council. They've invited me up to speak to them, and I look out over the audience, and there's about 250 tribal sheikhs looking back at me, and they all look like my dad. whose name is Monty. And so I tell my wife this, and she christens the group the group of 250 Montys. The other group you mentioned, the ones that were really interested in my background but kind of disappointed about it, was a group of students. I wanted to engage the students, thought they were a really vital part of the future of Iraq. And so I created these student forums where hundreds of students could come and speak to me, and I could talk to them. And we had interpreters, Iraqi interpreters, kind of planted in the audience just to kind of gauge the reaction of what I was saying and what was going on, the buzz behind the scene, if you will. And 90% of the audience was very interested in the fact that I was half Palestinian, and 50% of them were very disappointed as a result. And I couldn't figure out why, and we didn't ask the question, but it could have been they felt, you know, why is an Arab wearing an American uniform and occupying our country? It could have been just the fact that Saddam favored the Palestinians in a number of ways, and that there might have been some pushback to that. I don't know. I never got the answer to that one, but I did try to engage the various groups in Rusafa and Adamiya, my area of Baghdad, and those outreaches to these various groups are in Baghdad at sunrise and make some for, I think, some, they were made for some compelling moments in my life. I hope they made some compelling reading as well.
Well, in speaking of compelling moments, you had several challenges in Iraq personally. At one point, you learned that there was militia who were targeting you for assassination. In the book, you sort of joke about it. And in fact, it's very dark humor in a way. But you say that after the assassination attempt seemed to dissipate, that your colleagues, you know, basically said, okay, well, there, you know, you survived another day or something to that effect. And of course, you know, you deal with it in a humorous way, but the flip side of that, of course, are the very serious incidents you face where you actually had to confront death among your colleagues, you know, good friends of yours being killed by IEDs, you know, in the street. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the your approach to this, in a way, surreal atmosphere you faced, you know, both through with humor, but also through sadness. And this is the thing about your book. There is sadness here, and you do talk about grown men shedding tears, which again is one of the honest ways that your book comes to terms with what really happens in Iraq.
Well, I think a good sense of humor is necessary for any soldier to get through the events that he faces. It's a great story, though, in the book. We get this piece of intelligence through the Central Intelligence Agency that says, I've been doing too much, according to the people who are going to assassinate me, I've been doing too much interaction with the tribal sheikhs, being too effective at it, and therefore they're going to infiltrate the meeting at the next meeting and kill General Mansour. And my comment to my colleagues was, well, at least they promoted me before they assassinated me. But all that week in staff meetings, I would sit down and my staff would edge their chairs away from me. And then they'd put up these Far Side cartoons where, you know, the deer is in the hunter's sights and he's pointing at it, the other deer. So I go off to the meeting, and we had put in some extra security for the meeting and whatnot. And I felt quite safe and nothing happens. You know, I go into the room, and of course, earlier the council had made me a sheikh, so I walk in and they all go, Sheikh Mansour, Sheikh Mansour, and it was all, you know, roses and hugs. But I get back to the headquarters when that's all over, and I walk into the Tactical Operations Center, and there's my assistant intelligence officer, Bettina Gorzinski, and she kind of looks up and she goes, oh, sir, I see you're still alive. And everyone just rolls on the floor laughing. But there were also very serious incidents. You know, we lost 24 soldiers in Iraq, to include my very, very good friend and close confidant, Command Sergeant Major Eric Cook, who died practically in my arms shortly thereafter. And, you know, you have to deal with that as well. And, you know, it makes for emotional moments, but you have to go on from there. And one of the things I tried to do in Baghdad at sunrise is talk about not just, you know, dealing with this, but I tried to actually capture, you know, what I was thinking at the time. You know, like when he was killed, we were conducting a cordon in search of a neighborhood in Baghdad, and I was very, very angry. And I got up and I told the battalion commander on the site, I said, tear this blankety blank place apart. And it's probably not what I should have done as a brigade commander, but, you know, I am a human being with emotions, and I tried to capture those moments as well in the book. So I think it makes for a good memoir in that regard.
Well, in fact, if you want to take it a little farther, in that scene, you actually take out a pistol, aim it at someone who's on the second floor of a building, I believe, take out the laser mechanism, I mean, and make that work, and you say that you were very close, maybe not seriously, but very close to pulling the trigger. You were so upset. And in that sense, in the book, you have understanding, you could say empathy, for those U.S. military who actually abused Iraqi prisoners. You talk about that in the book a lot.
Actually, I don't have too much empathy for them. For those who abuse prisoners, it's different from when you're in the heat of the moment and you come face to face with some insurgents and you have to use a lot of self-discipline not to pull the trigger sometimes. But what the book does is talk about a number of incidents in my brigade and elsewhere where prisoners were abused and how I dealt with it as a commander. And I dealt with it fairly harshly, and I dealt with it up front. And as a result, you set a standard for your unit that then carries on through the end of the tour in Iraq. Regrettably, there were people in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere who didn't have the same standards, and they didn't make sure that the subordinates adhered to them. And as a result, there was a huge, as we all know, criminal actions ongoing in these prisons in Abu Ghraib, which had a huge strategic impact on the war.
As another reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're speaking with Colonel Peter Mansour about the U.S. Presence in Iraq. I'm Jonathan Curiel. Let's go to some of the next questions from our audience. Several questions have come forward about the surge. And one of the questions is, what's the biggest misconception about the surge? Now, as I said in the introduction, you were partly responsible for the surge in your strategic planning of the war. What is perhaps the biggest misconception about the surge?
I think the biggest misconception of the surge was that the addition of five additional brigade combat teams was the most important part of the surge, when in fact, actually, the most important part of the surge was the changing of the strategy from that of transitioning authority and responsibility for security to Iraqi forces that were fundamentally unprepared to accept those responsibilities in 2006 and 2007, to protecting the Iraqi people as the first and fundamental priority for coalition forces in Iraq. Because until you protect a population, you can't protect it from sectarian violence. You can't protect it from insurgents who would intimidate people and force them to support the insurgency. You cannot make political progress possible, not necessarily probable, but you can't even make political progress possible unless you can bring down the level of violence. And the only way to do that was for us to move off the big bases, to create smaller bases and combat outposts among the populations in the neighborhoods where they lived, and bring down the level of violence, especially the ethno-sectarian violence that was ripping Iraqi society apart. And I think what we've seen is that the surge worked in that regard. The security situation is much, much improved. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we've won the war, because the key is the Iraqi politics and where do they proceed from here. But what we've done is we've created the conditions for those politics to proceed. When General Petraeus and I got there in February 2007, one of our very first meetings was two Iraqi ministers on top of a table shouting at each other. You just could not move forward politically in Iraq until you brought the level of violence down. We've done that, and now we really do need to use the levers that we have at our disposal to push the Iraqi government towards reconciliation and an honest and fair sharing of power and resources in that country.
Now, you're a historian, and one of the things I learned in one of my beginning history classes was perception equals reality. You talk in your book a lot about the U.S. media and the Arab media, about how they shape perception of the war, and you give some credit to the U.S. media. You say that on average there was a 90-day lag time behind the reality and what the media reported, that the Arab media, though, was a lot worse. Can you talk about that now that you're, you know, back in the United States, really, about the way the media maybe misrepresented or didn't what happened and really what's happening now in Iraq?
Well, the common refrain from soldiers in Iraq is, oh, the media is not reporting any good news stories. But I don't really blame Western media for that. They're reporting what's newsworthy. And on the whole, the standards of reporting of Western news organizations was pretty good. It was not the same with all Arabic news media, especially Al Jazeera, at least initially. They would have a very slanted version of events. In many cases, they embedded reporters with the insurgency. One of the things we did is we'd look for Al Jazeera news crews in our area because it was often a signal that there was going to be an attack. We actually tried to engage Al Jazeera. We actually set up several interviews and had Al Jazeera reporters come in, tried to embed them with our units, and to bring them into the story, if you will. And it was just very, very difficult to get Al Jazeera to report with the kind of standards of rigor and journalistic excellence that most Western news organizations show. And the other thing about Arabic media, Western media, if someone gets it wrong, there will be another media outlet ready to pounce. And that's not the same. They don't have the same kind of case in Arabic media. If one of them gets it wrong, often another one will pick up the story and then embellish it rather than pushing back. So it was a real challenge getting the Arabic media to tell what we thought was a fairly balanced view of events.
Now, but both Arabic and American media, as one example from your book, both media focused on a situation in Iraq where U.S. military married Iraqi women, and you write about this in your book and how you had mixed feelings about it. I mean, you're happy for them; it's love, great. But on the other hand, and I wouldn't have thought about this myself. On the other hand, you say that they could have actually endangered the rest of the troops because who knows who the women's family, who that they knew, insurgents, et cetera, et cetera. I hadn't thought about that. Can you just talk about that kind of intersection in a way where the military, you know, members do marry with Iraqi women?
Well, there was a general order that prohibited fraternization with the local population, whether male or female. But I had two soldiers who married Iraqi women, and I didn't want to focus the situation on the marriage. I empathize with them. They fell in love. They got married. But I was very, very concerned that they had endangered the rest of the people in their squad by leaving this patrol to go get married. You know, what we saw after that, in the years after that, was American soldiers get kidnapped, American civilians get kidnapped, then used as pawns in a strategic game. And they didn't know if they were being set up. They didn't know these women for that long. And although I empathized with them in that regard in matters of love, I couldn't overlook the matters of military discipline. And so I gave them letters of reprimand and eventually released one of them from active duty. He was a National Guard soldier and sent him back to Florida.
Let's look at another question from the audience, and the question is this: do you think that American non-military intervention, educational opportunities, job creation, etc., could be effective or even possible in Iraq's future?
Well, Iraqis very much want U.S. involvement in the non-security aspects of their society. They want American economic interaction. They'd like our help in improving their government services. It's not like they're trying to push us away. So, yes, I think that involvement in Iraqi society and their economy and their government with non-military elements of our government especially the interagency officials who could do so much value over there, is a very, very important part of our strategy going forward, and again, gives us a little piece of leverage with Iraq, although the fact that we're not actually funding any reconstruction in Iraq anymore has taken some leverage off the table as well.
This is in the news several months ago, but it's a question from the audience about it's the role of private security companies like Blackwater. You get into that a little bit in Baghdad at Sunrise. But was it in a way frustrating for you as a military commander to have these sort of side military organizations or military units, quasi-military units really, working in the same capacity? And in some ways, I mean, this is maybe a separate issue, but in some ways earning a lot of money to do that, maybe even more than those in the U.S. military.
Yeah, the money didn't bother us too much, but it was extremely frustrating to have these security organizations, these private security companies working in our area. They didn't coordinate with us. They'd get in trouble and then need help, and there would be no mechanisms to communicate with them. They wouldn't have access to quick reaction forces, air support, and like. Not only that, but the ethic of a private security company is to get the package, whether it's a person or whatever, from point A to point B without the package being killed or wounded. And companies like Blackwater like to say, well, we've never lost a package in the performance of our duties in Iraq. And that may be true, but what they don't say is how many Iraqis did they kill and wound along the way to getting their packages safely from point A to point B. And this has a significant influence on the Iraqi attitudes towards us. These companies were unaccountable. They did not fall under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and neither did they fall under Iraqi law because there was a CPA order that made them immune from Iraqi prosecution. So in effect, they were above the law. And I believe in the future that all armed contractors must fall under a military chain of command and be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice if we are to use these security contractors. I much prefer have soldiers in uniform actually perform all security functions in a counterinsurgency operation. I feel that strongly about it because I think contractors do a great service, but I think they should be limited to the logistical functions, intelligence, and these other functions that do not include firing weapons at enemy or potential enemy forces.
Now, when you were in Iraq, you were centered in Baghdad, but you went around Iraq, especially southern Iraq. I'm not sure whether you went to the Kurdish region of Iraq, but one question we have from the audience is, would a partitioned Iraq be easier? And in some ways, you know, Kurdistan existed even before the Iraq War, and as a kind of separate from the rest of Iraq. But would it be easier for Iraq to be partitioned, essentially?
No. For one thing, very few Iraqis want the country to be partitioned. So if you want to partition Iraq, first you're going to have to convince them. But the other thing it would do would create permanent boundaries for perpetual conflict, at the intersection of these three regions. And so I think it would harm matters more than help it. I think the way forward is a unitary Iraqi state, and we've got to assist the Iraqis in working their way through this politically.
Another question from the audience. The question is, are Islam and democracy fundamentally incompatible? Now you were in Iraq, and you talked about your dealings with the sheikhs, and you understand Iraq as well as any military person in this country today. First of all, I mean, do you think that's a fair question when it's applied to Iraq? Is it really about religion, or is it about other things?
Well, I think it's a fair question, but I think Iraq may be not the best test case. Turkey is Islamic and yet has a very vibrant democracy. So I don't think Islam and democracy are incompatible, but I don't think we can expect a Jeffersonian democracy to somehow flower in the land of the two rivers. They have their own culture, they have their own history, and how they eventually form their representative form of government is going to be different than the way the United States does it.
We have 2 minutes left. We're down to one last question, and let's get a question from the audience. The question is this: have our actions in Iraq tipped the balance of power in the Middle East, making Iran very powerful and more dangerous And it seems, I don't know, let's hear your answer.
Regrettably, I think we have enabled Iran to actually expand its power and influence in the Middle East with our destruction of their major competitor, which was Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Now, I have no love for Saddam Hussein. He was a first-class thug. He murdered hundreds of thousands of his countrymen, and it's good that he's gone. But having said that, in terms of raw power, we did not think through what the destabilization of Iraq would do to Iran, and in fact, they've tried to fill the vacuum and have used Iraq as a proxy battleground for a war against the United States.
Well, our thanks to Colonel Peter Mansour, Chair of Military History at Ohio State University, the Executive Officer to the Commanding General of Operation Iraqi Freedom from 2007 to 2008, and author of the new book, Baghdad at Sunrise. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.